You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, America's top law enforcement officer is out of a job. As James Comey gets fired by Donald Trump, I'll discuss the fallout with my guests Samira Shackle and Michael Binion. Plus, political responses to the refugee crisis, the electoral struggles of France's next president, and a leaky Labour manifesto here in the UK. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, a freelance journalist, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times. Samira and Michael, welcome to you both. We'll begin with the dismissal last night of FBI Director James Comey, a story we've obviously been following on here since it happened. Comey was fired by Donald Trump ostensibly due to his handling of an investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, though it's fair to say that not everyone believes that might be the case. Critics were quick to point out the timing immediately following Comey's request for more funds to investigate alleged Russian meddling in the US presidential election. Michael, I mean, where do we even begin with this?
With the makings and the mushrooming of a grand conspiracy. And we begin with allegations, counter-allegations, and then accusations of cover-up, then more cover-up, and then accusations of hiding the facts. And in fact, it has all the beginnings of a wonderful American scandal that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and may eventually unmask a smoking gun, though we don't know. But the thing is that this is very much influenced by hindsight. It's influenced by memories of Watergate, of something that appeared a bit dodgy and a bit odd at first, where there were denials and counter-denials or allegations, which in the end did find that some fishy stuff had gone on. And that's what everybody, or most people, certainly all the Democrats, and I have to say a fair number of Republicans, now suspect over the Comey affair.
Although what's striking, Samira, is that as with everything outrageous that Donald Trump has done, there is a partisan split in America. And so far, I believe there are just over 70 Democrats in Congress and Senate who have called for a special prosecutor. There are zero Republicans who've called for a special prosecutor.
Yeah, I find that really striking because obviously, you know, I think here we can't, particularly in the UK, be superior about partisan splits. But the fact is that it's it's sort of at the next level in the US, I think, that sort of level of partisanship where it's sort of party above all else, above, you know, the American political system. Whenever you hear politicians speak in media, the Constitution is held up as this sort of paragon of what we should be sort of guided by and sticking to. They're incredibly proud of the Constitution. It's supposed to be the guiding principle. And yet you have Republicans not particularly interested in upholding either sort of convention or constitutional practices and so on for the sake of partisanship. And this is all, these are, you know, the same people who vehemently opposed Trump before he became their president. So I think it's worrying because we won't see, for instance, the in this case, the investigation without Republicans coming on board. And it's quite difficult to see what will make them break ranks, those Republicans, that number of Republicans that you need to break ranks in order to see any action as Trump behaves in increasingly despotic manners. Because, yeah, it is worrying, sort of sacking officials, et cetera, et cetera.
Michael, you mentioned Watergate, and obviously lots of people are sort of referring to that. But this, in a way, feels a little different because at least with Watergate, people were living then in an age where democratic norms existed. And, you know, you look at the situation now with Donald Trump, there is no guarantee that a new FBI director is going to continue the investigation into Russia. There is no guarantee that if this whole thing is quietly shelved or starved of resources, as is being suggested by some Democrats, that there'll be any fallout from this.
No, indeed. I think it would be very difficult in the light of public opinion and the sort of uproar that is growing in the US to simply say it won't go any further, or indeed to fire another FBI director if he doesn't listen to guidance from the White House. Mr. Trump has perfect legitimacy. He is perfectly entitled to sack the FBI director. It's in his power. And he doesn't have to give a reason, though obviously it would be very odd if he didn't. The reason he's given seems very suspect to many people, given the fact that he's now suddenly switched and said that the man acted unfairly over Hillary Clinton, having himself called Hillary Clinton a crook throughout his election campaign. So I think he would find it very, very hard, really, to stymie any further investigation, particularly if the new FBI director decided it had to continue. And I think it would be very hard to find a director of the FBI who wouldn't continue the investigation that's already started.
Samira, let's assume there is a new FBI director who decides to continue the investigation and puts the resources in that are necessary. The other thing one suspects has happened here is that any report subsequently brought out by the FBI is going to be muddied somewhat by this, that if actually it turns out Donald Trump genuinely didn't do anything wrong and had no ties to Russia whatsoever and was just a bit of a big mouth saying, come on, Russia, leak these emails, and just had a couple of dodgy advisors, very few people are going to believe that.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And that's the sort of own goal of this. Trump, if you see the sort of White House team in the last couple of days scrambling around to justify Trump's decision and sort of pulling out Democrats having criticised Comey when he made the announcement about Clinton's emails just before the election, saying, well, see, you said he wasn't fit for purpose either. It's all quite desperate and implies that they seem to be surprised at the scale of public outcry and backlash about this move. But it's not just that that's an own goal. As you say, I think it will sort of cast doubt on the sort of future report that does come out. But I'm not sure Trump thinks that far ahead on anything. It's really sort of immediately responsive, quite impulsive decision making on all counts, and in this, as we've seen on other things, I think is no different. And while you'd hope that the next FBI director will continue the investigation, as you mentioned earlier, it's quite possible to do things like not give the extra resources, etc., etc. So there are ways of sort of allowing it to go on, but dampening the impact.
And then, Michael, the other thing which might prevent anything really coming out is that, you know, is there an appetite in America to know about all this? Is there do enough voters actually care about this as an issue? Or will, you know, let's say the economy keeps pootling along, doing all right, some jobs come back, will people on the whole think, well, you know, this Russia stuff doesn't really matter?
I don't think people are particularly interested in the outcome of the Russia stuff, although I have to say a lot of people are very sort of worried about the idea that their president might have had some murky dealings with Russia. What I think is the bigger concern is we don't want a president wounded so early in his presidency. If it looks like this is rolling towards a possible impeachment proceedings, well, we've hardly given the man a chance to show who he is or what he can do. Of course, many people say we'll never really know who he is, but certainly he's not proved whether he can accomplish any of his goals or put his policies into action. And I think many people think it's really too early in his presidency to start a massive impeachment proceedings, which would mean we would lose a year at most, or, well, a year at least, in fact, and then possibly end up with, having to get rid of him so early.
Samira, any talk of impeachment is perhaps a little premature in the sense that Republicans are very, very unlikely to push this while Trump remains popular among other Republicans. But do you think as we approach the midterm elections in 2018, which, you know, in political terms in the US isn't that far away, that if his popularity ratings remain as low as they are in the high 30s, early 40s, that you'll see some Republicans peeling away from him?
You'd hope so. I mean, I think that, I think that what's striking is how much Trump's popularity and approval ratings from the polls that I've seen has dropped. They're exceptionally low for this stage in his presidency, even amongst his sort of core constituency. So early, this early on, you'd expect someone to still have a bit of a honeymoon grace period. And while he'll obviously have the hardcore supporters for a while, his popularity ratings really have dropped. And I think given that the Republican Party doesn't seem much bound by much in the way of principle or sort of looking at Democratic convention and so on, I think that perhaps that popularity question is the one thing that might cause some of them to break ranks and speak out about some of this stuff. But we'll just have to see.
I would just say that, on the other hand, he does have what they call the grown-ups in the White House. He has three very substantial figures around him, close to him, who may have a greater influence if he feels he's personally struggling. He may give more power to the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Chief of the White House staff, all of whom have pretty solid approval ratings by the American public, and all of whom, so far, seem to have performed pretty well. They could, in a way, solidify and underpin the presidency, allowing it to achieve something.
OK, let's move on now to another country with a new president, well, president-elect anyway, and that's France. The party of the newly elected president-elect, Emmanuel Macron, has today announced a list of candidates for parliamentary elections, which take place next month. The list includes 428 candidates. There are still more than 100 slots to be filled, though, because it is a 577-seat parliament. And Samira, the fact that they haven't filled that is shows just how difficult it is when you're starting a party from scratch. But what's interesting is half of those selected so far are women. The average age is, I think, around 42, whereas the average age of a parliamentarian in France is around about 60. Mm. So you get the sense this is a new broom.
Yeah, definitely. They're trying to do something big. And the reason they've given, I mean, when you see the headline that says they're going to be short of the 577, you think they don't have enough people, but actually it's just a case of processing. I think they've had something like 15 or 16,000 applicants to be candidates since January, and sort of nearly 2,000, I think, just since Macron won the presidency or entered the second round. So it's a huge amount of vetting to do. And yeah, as you say, it shows the challenges of starting a new party. This party is barely a year old, I think, and of sort of delivering this sea change that they've promised in French politics of having more women, having more young people, having people who don't have these sort of long political records, sort of getting rid of that sense of cronyism. That's a huge job. Yeah, you just have to hope that they pull it together, because, you know, we've just been talking about the Trump presidency and whether it will achieve anything. And Macron will really struggle if he doesn't have a majority to push through all the radical reforms he's promised.
One of the challenges, Michael, that Emmanuel Macron will face here is that there are many contradictions within the Macron candidacy, but they were all within one man, and he was the one that could say, well, this is what I believe and this is what I think. The moment that you have, whether it's 400 or 577 in the end, candidates from a fairly broad spectrum of from centre-left to centre-right, there are going to be differences of opinion, and sometimes quite big differences of opinion between those candidates.
That is always the problem of a centre party. You don't know where to draw the limits on either side. You don't know how far to the left to go in social policies, for example, or how far to the right in economic policy to go. And defining your borders and defining what sort of candidate you want will be very difficult. And on top of that, you've got quite a few opportunists from the established parties who think they should jump ship now, because obviously their own parties are in disarray and in chaos, especially the socialists, I have to say. So they'd like to quickly latch onto the coattails of Mr. Macron and say, yes, yes, we've always been with you. Now, one prominent man has already done so, namely the former Prime Minister, Mr. Valls, and whether or not Macron will take him, having been so closely associated with the last years of Hollande, a deeply unpopular president, is unclear. I mean, he is the sort of person that would fit very well into this new category, but, of course, it looks as though if you're recycling others who are saying, now we're going to join the new party, then it doesn't look like a new party at all.
And it would be interesting, Samira, to see what happens after the results come in and we have an idea of what the new National Assembly looks like. Because if En Marche, Macron's party, doesn't have a majority, does he try to have a minority administration, or is it some form of coalition, most likely with the socialists, but depending on who's obviously leading the Le Républicain on the centre-right, with it's a Juppé figure more than a Sarkozy figure, he might find there's a home there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just going to be really interesting to see how it pans out. And As we've just been saying, the sort of the issue with being a centrist party also is not just about who is within your own party, it's also who you ally yourselves to. We saw that with the Liberal Democrat coalition here in 2010 and the sort of support they lost from the sort of centre-left voters. And so I think that's the kind of risk that Macron will be running if he does end up in a position where he needs to form a minority government, because, you know, I think what the one thing that came resoundingly out of the presidential race in France was a real dissatisfaction with the established political order and absolute routing of the socialist candidate. I think he got, what, like 6%? Something like that. I mean, it's shocking, really, if you think how long they were in power for. So I think it's a delicate balance, and you can see why they'd really be gunning for a clear majority, because it'll be difficult to navigate those alliances and not become immediately sullied by connection.
Michael, do you think that the result will be some sort of realignment within the centre-left, that there will be a centre-left social democratic majority within the National Assembly that in some ways, I guess, sort of puts to sword this idea that populism is on the rise and that the centre-left don't have any ideas left?
There might be, and that would be interesting, because it would be, in a way, a creation of a sort of French version of Blairism, just at the very moment when Blairism in Britain is completely out of fashion. Mm. And people are despairing about the fact that in Britain there is no moderate centre-left. There's left, but there's not centre-left, at least not one that seems to be a political force. There is, of course, as we'll be talking about soon, the Liberal Democrats in Britain, but the French don't have that equivalent, and they haven't had for some time. It's been a much more polarised left-right division, and indeed in France, far-left and far-right, both of whom polled pretty well during the election. Now, whether that's reflected in the parliamentary vote, I'm not quite sure. But I think, given the fact that this was a very spectacular victory, I think there will be a lot of people hoping for ambitious personal ambition and selfish reasons to be part of that bandwagon and jump on it, and possibly there will be a majority.
OK. We'll leave it there. Michael Binion, Samira Shackle, thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back with both Samira and Michael after this.
Gotland, an isolated Swedish island in the middle of the Baltic Sea, has more to it than meets the eye. Monocle Films lands on Gotland to see how the flare-up in the Baltic region has seen tensions rising in Sweden.
My impression is that the Baltic states feel moral pressure from the Russian side. We have espionage in Sweden. We work with it all the time, and it's very important for Sweden to have capability to defend our democracy.
Out on the film pages of Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Samira Shackle and Michael Binion. Let's turn now to the UK, where last night a draft manifesto of the Labour Party was leaked, including plans for the abolition of tuition fees and nationalisation in the energy and rail sectors, plus Royal Mail. Samira, in a sense, the Labour Party's got two bites of the cherry here, because they'll release it properly, probably next week. But all the policies have come out now. It has been criticised, it's fair to say, by the right-wing press as a terrible document that will drag Britain back to the 1970s. Some of these same papers have also been quite keen to drag Britain back to the 1950s. Yep. but let's leave that to one side. Is it, though, as left-wing as they are making out?
I think generally over the last, sort of even before the manifesto, one of the most compelling criticisms, in fact, that I've seen of the kind of Corbyn leadership and team around him is that they speak the very radical language, but actually lots of their policies are straight out of Ed Miliband's time as Labour leader, when sort of proposing very similar policies, but just couched in a more centrist language. And I think that's sort of been a criticism throughout the last, definitely the last 6 months or so. I think there's definitely stuff in here that is fairly left-wing. And I think I've seen various people on my personal social media echo chamber being quite excited about that. I think actually having what seems like a sort of genuinely progressive platform to vote for and things which are broadly quite popular, things like nationalising certain services, and so on, sort of more money for the NHS, etc. But I think, just to go back to your question, it's not a kind of wildly radical proposing some super high rate of tax or whatever. It's the amount of corporation tax. I can't remember the exact figure that they're proposing, but it's lower than it was when Blair left office.
It's rising from 19% to 26%. Yeah. And when the Tories came into power in 2010, it was 28%.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not...
It's not radical. You know, they're proposing a higher rate of tax for earners over 80,000, which isn't a huge percentage of the population. So I think if we were seeing a really radical left-wing restructuring of the economy, it would look quite different to that, I think. It doesn't talk about sort of reversing things like cuts to legal aid or the universal credit, various different welfare things. Doesn't really get into that. So it's not actually, while it is a sort of, it's a clear, clearly different platform to the Tories, and it is a, I think, a pretty left-wing in some respects. It's not a wildly radical socialist revolution, I'd say.
Michael, what's striking about this is that Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader of the Labour Party twice because he was seen as a left-wing radical who was different from these sort of from these centrists and moderates and people who tried to couch their language and try to appeal to the middle classes as well as just the traditional working class supporters of the Labour Party. And yet things that him and his allies have talked about in the past, a 60% rate of tax for some taxpayers, getting rid of MI5 or abolishing the army, certain things like that. That's nowhere near here. This is a soft left manifesto, really, isn't it?
It is indeed. And that raises a question as to who leaked it and why. Who was trying to embarrass whom by leaking it? Was it the centre ground who thought that by leaking it, that would discredit Corbyn, showing that he actually had not got the support of his grassroots far left, and that actually he also didn't have control of the whole party because he was saying one thing but the manifesto was saying another? Or was it leaked by Corbyn's supporters in order to show, actually, we are a sensible, pragmatic party which is able to do things, and you will see when the final manifesto comes out that this is a kind of platform that many people will vote for. I agree. What is very odd is that the platform seems to be pretty much traditional Labour, but I don't think it will really help Labour very much, even though many of the policies are individually quite popular. And indeed, some of the policies are those that the Tories themselves would like to support. The problem is that they're being voiced or fronted by a person who is personally without much credibility as a leader in the country. And in the end, one begins to think people vote for the leader figure, the so-called president, it's not prime minister, and not the platform, not the policies. People don't really believe that the manifesto does actually reflect what will be put into politics or not.
And that's interesting, isn't it, Samira? Because when it comes down to it, yes, a manifesto is important in some ways, but people will be, on the whole, making their choice based on who they think the best leader is. Now, we can talk forever about what makes a good leader, but there's that. And there's the other is, actually, who you trust to run the economy, because it's all very well saying, well, I'd quite like railways to be nationalised, or I'd quite like there to, tuition fees to be abolished. But if I don't trust this person, this organisation to run the economy, these things are never going to happen anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the big problem that Labour has, because, I mean, you know, the last year or so, certainly it's been absolutely the main story about Labour has been these internal splits, this sort of incompetence in the leadership, etc., etc. That's going to be really hard to overcome. And we're going into an election with a Labour leader with historically low poll ratings and Theresa May with enormously high popularity ratings, personal popularity. And so I think that's quite hard to bridge regardless of what the platform is. I think you also saw it in terms of this question of being trustworthy on the economy. You really saw that in the 2015 election when, sort of conscious of that criticism, the manifesto that Labour released was incredibly well costed and thoroughly sort of down to the last penny in order to see off this criticism that Labour is irresponsible and can't be trusted on the economy. The Conservative manifesto did absolutely none of that. It was all sort of unicorns and blah, 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 etc., deficit of nothing, migration under 10,000, etc., etc. That wasn't really picked up on. The story that was still in the sort of widely read, broadly right-wing press was terrifying chaos with Labour, strong, stable with Conservatives, which obviously, where, I mean, where did that get us? But if you see there's a sort of
disparity. I don't know, the last 2 years have been very stable here in the UK. It's interesting to mention it's strong. So Theresa May has been criticised by some sections of the media and some politics watchers for consistently saying, Michael, strong and stable, strong and stable, strong and stable. She gets it into every answer. Even she was asked the other day about her childhood and she said it was very stable. She said stable twice, just talking about that. And she's been mocked mercilessly for this. However, when you ask the ordinary voter, you know, can tell us, you know, what Theresa May's slogan is or the Tory party's slogan is, just 15% of the population have heard of strong and stable, compared to hardly any who've heard of Labour's slogan, which, I'll be honest, I can't even remember myself. When people come to make their choice, it is down to, you know, what they think of the leader, the image that they have, a general feeling, and certain snippets here and there, not whether there's a fully costed 60-page manifesto.
Exactly. And one wonders really whether manifestos are worth all the effort that go into them. Sometimes they're more of a hindrance to the party than a help, because they find that they're hampered by promises or shackled by promises made in a manifesto. And we saw that very clearly just this year, where the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the equivalent finance minister in Britain, tried to introduce a reform that was specifically excluded from the Conservative manifesto of 2015. Yes, people only have a hazy idea of manifestos, indeed of slogans and campaigns. They slightly switch off. They do tend to focus on the leader of the party, but how they form their opinions is unclear. And I think Theresa May's great strength at the moment is she's completely unknown. We know she's a figure who is very closely guarded, reserved, very tight-lipped. She says certain number of things, very sort of bland things. Brexit means Brexit. We got that again and again and again. We don't really know what her political philosophy is. Now, that can be a help because it keeps her something of an enigma. But in the end, it could possibly be a great hindrance because they say, can we vote for somebody we don't know?
Samira, let's move on to our final topic, which sort of wraps in a number of things we've talked about, which is one of the other political parties here in the UK, the Liberal Democrats, saying they want to resettle an additional 50,000 Syrian refugees in the UK. And it was striking looking at Emmanuel Macron's victory in that he was unashamedly pro-refugee and said, you know, in the interview that he did with Monocle 3 or 4 months ago, he talked about how important it was to accept refugees, and the moment that we start questioning, you know, whether they should come here, we're, you know, what are we for? Who are we? Have you been surprised that there's been less discussion about refugees in the UK election so far?
Kind of not surprised, I think, because it's become such a toxic issue and it's quite a sort of self-perpetuating sort of vicious circle where you have the assumption that there's hostility to refugees, which and then hostility to refugees is sort of reinforced throughout sort of media political discourse. It's quite hard to see where one ends and the other begins, where sort of public hostility and that sort of rhetoric for in sort of media and politics, which were sort of chicken and egg, as it were. It's quite self-perpetuating. And when that's the assumption, it's something that people just want, politicians, parties just want to stay away from when it comes to an election campaign, just sort of brush that aside. I think that it's quite refreshing. I mean, the Liberal Democrats are obviously not going to be the main party of government. We know that. They've got, what, 6 or 7 MPs at the moment. But it is quite refreshing to see what is ostensibly one of the three main parties making this argument quite unashamedly, because I think that it's something that left and right alike are quite nervous about. You saw that in the last election in 2015 with those horrible mugs that Labour made, those sort of no to immigration mugs, vote Labour or whatever they were. And so I think seeing that moral argument made is refreshing, and I would hope is something that would be picked up by other parties, because I think I wouldn't know about numbers, but I think there is a constituency of people who've seen all the stories. There's a level of empathy. There's lots of people going before the jungle was shut, going back and forth to Calais, etc. And seeing that argument made that no, we shouldn't have dropped the scheme to resettle child refugees, or we shouldn't have sort of undershot so much on our commitment to take a certain number of Syrian refugees, etc. I think it's good to see that argument made.
Okay, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Samira Shackle, Michael Binion, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Guy Lutz and Hunter Charlton. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew-Banerjee. More music next. Then at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And we'll all have more on the day's main stories, of course, on the Monocle Daily. That's 2200 here in London, 1700 if you're listening in New York City. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, my name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.